Welcome to the voter ID cases in Wisconsin, Texas. What's next? And I'll now turn the call over to Katie O'Connor.
Thank you, and hello, everybody. I'm Katie O'Connor, Director of Policy Development and Programming here at the American Constitution Society. Thank you for joining us for today's call on the voter ID cases in Wisconsin and Texas. I have a couple of housekeeping items before we get started. First, please note that today's call is being recorded and we'll be providing a link to the recording after the call. Second, we have reserved some time at the end of the call for questions and answers, and we'll give instructions for asking questions at that time. And finally, 1 hour of California CLE credit is available for this call. If you'd like to receive credit and haven't done so already, please email Matt Scoble at mscoble@acslaw.org to request that paperwork. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with ACS, we are a national network of lawyers, scholars, law students, judges, and policymakers who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. ACS works for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional issues through the development and promotion of high-impact ideas. If you support these efforts and are not yet a formal part of our network, I encourage you to become a member of ACS today. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's speakers and to congratulate them on these amazing voting rights victories. Jerry Hebert is the Executive Director and Director of Litigation at the Campaign Legal Center, where he's been since 2004. From 1973 to 1994, Jerry served in the Department of Justice, where he served in several supervisory capacities, including Acting Chief, Deputy Chief, and Special Litigation Counsel in the Voting Section of the Civil Rights Division. In 1994, Jerry left DOJ and opened a solo law practice specializing in election law and redistricting. Jerry's legal practice is national in scope, representing clients, including many local governments, in Texas, California, New York, South Carolina, and Virginia, among other states. Over the last three decades, he has served as legal counsel in numerous redistricting lawsuits, including several cases decided in the U.S. Supreme Court. And Sean Young is a senior staff attorney for the ACLU's Voting Rights Project. He has been actively involved in litigating cases around the country challenging discriminatory voter identification requirements, cutbacks to early voting and same-day registration, and other attempts to make it harder to vote. Prior to joining the ACLU, he clerked for Judge Ann Claire Williams on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit and for Judge Laura Taylor Swain on the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. He also served as an associate at Skadden, where he litigated a variety of pro bono matters involving civil rights, fair housing, and racial justice issues. Sean is a graduate of Yale Law School and Duke University. I decided I was just going to go chronologically on this, so I'm going to hand it over to Sean, whose decision came down just one day before Jerry's. So, Sean, if you want to walk us through Frank versus Walker, the Wisconsin case.
Sure, and thank you for having me. And it's a real honor to even be speaking alongside such a giant like Jerry Hebert. First thing I'm going to talk about is the national implications of the Wisconsin voter ID case, and then I'm going to try to explain quickly the claims that we brought in this case and its history and what the next steps might be. So the Wisconsin case challenges Wisconsin's strict voter ID law, which was passed in 2011, which requires voters to show one of a limited number of types of photo identification in order to vote. This case has national implications for three reasons. First, this law, like Texas's, is one of the harshest in the country, and it's a threat to our democracy. It burdens or disenfranchises up to 300,000 Wisconsin voters. That's 9% of their registered voters, and with an especially great impact on lower-income voters and racial minorities who are twice as likely to lack ID. Over a dozen states have passed increasingly restrictive voter ID laws in the last decade. The second point is that this case is really important because it puts a spotlight on the lives of economically marginalized voters. Many voting rights cases, they're not about your middle-class voter or upper-income voters, which probably describes almost everyone on this call, and which is why it's sometimes hard for a lot of Americans to understand why these laws are so bad. These cases are about the impact that these laws have on vulnerable voters, and these are the types of folks that we should be welcoming into our democracy, not excluding. A lot of these folks have never needed photo ID, and they can't get them easily. They don't drive cars, they don't fly on planes, they don't check into hotels, and they can't just take time off of work to go to the DMV or they'll get fired. And then lastly, this case is important because Wisconsin's voter ID law is part and parcel of a wave of voter suppression laws that were passed after African Americans turned out to vote in record-breaking numbers in 2008. That's kind of sadly unsurprising because in the last 150 years, whenever African Americans have started to gain political power, the state governments have stopped at nothing to exclude them from our democracy. So on to the history of this case. We call Wisconsin's voter ID law a strict law because it requires photo identification, not other kinds of identification like Social Security cards, and it doesn't provide any exceptions for people who don't have ID or have a hard time getting it. We filed this lawsuit in 2011 challenging law basically on three grounds. Number one, that the voter ID law imposed a burden on many voters without justification in violation of the 14th Amendment. Number two, that the voter ID law had a discriminatory impact in violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And three, that the voter ID law violated equal protection because it only allowed certain kinds of photo ID while excluding others, such as veteran photo ID cards and technical college photo ID cards. As for this last claim, after we litigated the equal protection claim for some time and it became apparent that the Wisconsin legislature had no reason to exclude these cards, the Wisconsin legislature eventually allowed veterans and technical college IDs to be included. So that claim dropped out. In 2013, we had a two-week trial featuring over 40 fact witnesses, multiple experts, hundreds of exhibits, thousands of pages of testimony, and after which the district court found that the voter ID law violated the 14th Amendment and Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. It found that up to 300,000 voters would be significantly burdened by the law, that the burdens fell disproportionately on racial and linguistic minorities who are twice as likely to lack ID, and that Wisconsin's purported interests in preventing voter impersonation fraud with a strict voter ID law was not actually substantiated by evidence. And so in 2013, the district court enjoined the law, blocked the law in its entirety. And then in 2014, a panel of the Seventh Circuit, it was appealed, and they reversed that decision, in a decision that we have all come to call Frank 1, saying basically that the law shouldn't be struck down since most people have ID and there wasn't any voting discrimination because the law doesn't differentiate between black and white voters. This decision was a complete and total misreading of the case law and of the text of Section 2. So we petitioned for en banc rehearing of that decision, and the Seventh Circuit split 5-5 on whether to rehear that case. Judge Posner and the dissenting judges strongly criticized the decision, and the Supreme Court denied our cert petition. And so the case got sent back down to the district court in 2015. After it was sent back down, we asked the district court to create an affidavit option that would allow voters who have difficulties getting ID to vote by an affidavit without having to show ID. The district court said that it couldn't do this because Frank 1 had tied its hands. So we appealed that decision, and then in early 2006, in a decision that we call Frank number 2, the Seventh Circuit said that its prior decision in Frank 1 didn't preclude the district court from giving relief to voters who can't obtain ID with reasonable effort. So we went back to the district court. We moved for a preliminary injunction recently, and we asked that the court order the affidavit option be implemented in time for this November's elections. And importantly, and this is actually very important, we ask that that voters who sign an affidavit be given a regular ballot, not a provisional ballot. The reason this is so important is because provisional ballots are, first of all, a lot of people don't know what they are. And that's kind of the point. They're extremely confusing to voters and to even poll workers themselves. when you vote a provisional ballot, there's no guarantee that it will actually be counted. And in fact, many of them simply aren't counted. Elections officials in particular don't like dealing with them because they have to sift through all of them after an election. We thought it was very important, because it is, that these voters who sign an affidavit are not treated like second-class citizens, and that they be issued regular ballots like everyone else. And the district court just last Tuesday granted our motion for preliminary injunction, ordered that the affidavit option be implemented this November and while this case is pending, and specifically ordered that voters who vote by affidavit be issued a regular ballot. And so this was a rather significant victory for us. I believe it is the first court decision that has ordered this kind of remedy. But I still want to emphasize that, you know, as excited as we are about this victory, the affidavit option is the lesser of two evils. The devil is in its implementation. We've seen reports out of North Carolina and South Carolina that show that their affidavit option is not widely publicized, has not been implemented in a fair manner, and a lot of people still don't even know about them. And so we think that given the record in this case, strict voter ID laws have no place in our democracy. They should be struck down. They're based on a myth that about voter fraud that doesn't exist in substantial numbers. They're not justified. And the prime purpose of these laws is to make sure that vulnerable voters, especially racial minorities, can't participate in our democracy. And so we want to emphasize that while this affidavit option is a significant victory, it is under the pretense that Frank 1 was correctly decided, because that is the circuit precedent. And it's our continued position that voter ID laws should be struck down in their entirety. Last Friday, Wisconsin appealed the preliminary injunction decision and also asked the district court for a stay of that decision. So we are waiting for the district court to rule on that motion for a stay. And that's where we are now.
Excellent. All right. So, Jerry, do you want to sort of walk us through the Texas case now?
Yes, happy to do that. And I want to also thank ACS for convening this call about two very important cases that will impact the fall elections. And I'm also honored to be on the phone with ACLU lawyers, and especially Sean, who I have great admiration and respect for. And I just want to take my hat off to the Wisconsin team for really keeping their eye on the ball, and notwithstanding the Seventh Circuit's decision and the Supreme Court's denial of cert, for continuing to press for the fundamental right to vote's protection in Wisconsin. I think what you'll find after listening to me talk about the Texas case and having heard Sean talk about Wisconsin is that both cases illustrate the difficulties and burdens, both time-consuming as well as costly by way of expense, of litigation of this kind, statewide litigation challenging restrictions on the right to vote. In Texas, the struggle began in 2011, and here we are 5 years later, in the midst still of trying to get an effective remedy for the established and proven violation. So let me take you back to 2011, when the Texas legislature passed the strictest and most onerous photo ID law in the country. And I won't go into the details about, you know, what the state claimed was its reasons for doing so and what other legislators who opposed it said. I think it's fair to say that Texas passed the law in 2011, the same year they passed redistricting plans in the same session that were found to be discriminatory. And when they went through and decided what IDs could be used in the legislature, they picked and chose carefully what IDs could be used and which ones would not be allowed. So, for example, state employment IDs could not be used, federal IDs, federal employment IDs, an FBI agent's credentials or a Texas Ranger's credentials could not be used. Student IDs could not be used. What could be used were, of course, a passport, a driver's license and a license to carry a firearm in Texas. And what the record showed was at the time they made those decisions about which IDs they could use and which ones they wouldn't allow, that Texas knew, and the record, public record showed, that the ones that they were rejecting were disproportionately held by minority voters, and those that they chose were disproportionately held by Anglo or white voters. Fortunately, at the time they adopted it in 2011, Texas was a pre-clearance state, meaning that the state had to undergo approval of any voting law that they passed, and of course a photo ID law affects voting. So they went to the federal court in Washington, D.C., and filed a lawsuit seeking pre-clearance approval of their photo ID law. And in 2012, a unanimous three-judge federal court found that the law would have a racially discriminatory impact after conducting a trial on the matter in February, in the spring of 2012. And Texas appealed, and while that appeal was pending, the Supreme Court in the Shelby County decision nullified a key provision of the Voting Rights Act, which had the effect of eliminating the injunction that had been entered by the D.C. federal court, saying that this law was discriminatory. And within hours of the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby County, the Texas Attorney General at the time, Greg Abbott, now Governor Abbott, announced that the Texas ID law was immediately in effect because Section 5 preclearance had been nullified. So that kind of switched the burden to us, those of us who had represented minority voters in Texas and who had intervened in the district court in D.C., to file a lawsuit. And a lawsuit was filed within days after the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby challenging the law in Texas. That was in 2013. The case went to trial in 2014 after almost a year of discovery. And numerous groups participated as plaintiffs. The Justice Department followed after we had filed, and by say we, I meant Congressman Mark Vesey from Fort Worth and other minority voters across the state had filed first. And then we had a number of other voting rights groups come in and try to protect the right to vote for their clients, the Legal Defense Fund, the Lawyers Committee, the Brennan Center, and the NAACP, and as I mentioned, the Justice Department. So we all go to trial in 2014 in the fall, and the federal court finds that the photo ID law violates not only Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits voting practices that have a discriminatory result. It also found that the law was motivated by a racially discriminatory intent in violation of the 14th and 15th Amendments and Section 2. And it also found that it burdened unconstitutionally the fundamental right to vote under both the 1st and 14th Amendment. And similarly found that because in order to get the ID, if you didn't have one, you had to present a birth certificate, which at the time cost money, that it was also an unconstitutional poll tax. So Texas was ordered and enjoined from using the ID in 2014. In the 2014 elections, Texas sought an immediate stay in the Fifth Circuit, which they obtained of that order, which then allowed them to use the ID for the 2014 elections. And we went to the U.S. Supreme Court and asked the Supreme Court to vacate that stay. Excuse me. And in the fall of 2014, the Supreme Court refused to do that. It was famously written up that Justice Ginsburg stayed up all night to write a very lengthy and, frankly, poignant dissent, along with Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, agreeing with her that they would have vacated the stay. So the law went in effect for the 2014 elections. Meanwhile, Texas appealed the decision below on the merits to the Fifth Circuit, in addition to having obtained the stay. And there was briefing and oral argument, and the Fifth Circuit's panel agreed that the law was discriminatory in violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, the statutory claim. With respect to the constitutional claims, they invoked the doctrine of constitutional avoidance and said we don't need to reach a lot of those issues. They importantly remanded the issue of intent, however, because they felt that the district court had considered some evidence from opponents of the photo ID law that should not have been considered in the analysis, so they asked the district judge to re-examine it. Meanwhile, and this is where 2016 finally comes about, after the panel rendered its decision, Texas in 2015 sought a rehearing en banc in the entire Fifth Circuit, 15 judges. The petition remained pending for nearly 6 months. And after the March super primary in 2016, the VC team, the VC plaintiffs filed requests with the Fifth Circuit saying that the court needed to rule on the petition for rehearing en banc because we were going to be soon in a position not to be able to get relief for the fall elections of 2016. And the Fifth Circuit, ruled that eventually they would grant the petition and ordered a briefing schedule. The problem then became the briefing schedule really didn't guarantee a decision in time for the fall election. So the VC team then went, and this was a matter of some controversy because we were the only group to have done so, we went to the Supreme Court again and said, basically the Fifth Circuit is trying to string us out here to a point where we're going to be so far into the 2016 election cycle that no matter what happens, if they don't render a decision in time, we won't be in a position to get timely relief. So we asked the Supreme Court to vacate the stay that had been entered so that at least the ID would be in effect, would not be in effect for the 2016 election. The Supreme Court didn't grant our request, but did do something that had a major impact on the case favorably to us. It ruled that Texas Court of Appeals, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, had to rule in the Texas case by July 20th, or else they invited us to come back to the Supreme Court for relief. And lo and behold, the Fifth Circuit, after having oral argument and briefing, the en banc court ruled 9-6, just a little over a week ago, that the law did violate Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, as the original panel had declared, and that it also remanded the intent question, as the original panel had done, and it invoked constitutional avoidance on the constitutional claims on the burden on the right to vote, and it disagreed that the law was a poll tax. I should note, footnote there, that Texas, while the case was pending in the Court of Appeals, repealed the administrative fee you had to pay to get the birth certificate, which we thought essentially mooted that part of the case. So we're now back down to the district court, and we are in negotiations with the state about what the remedy should be for the fall elections. The court has entered a briefing schedule that is accelerated. And if no agreement is reached during our meet and confer period, which ends this week, we are going to be filing briefs next week on what the appropriate remedy should be. I will say, and I want to highlight something that Sean said, which is I think it's critical that any relief that we obtain in this case for the fall give voters who sign an affidavit the right to cast a regular ballot rather than a provisional ballot. Because these are voters that are on the rolls, they are on the voter registration rolls, but they don't have, for one reason or another, due to some impediment, inability to get the restricted photo IDs. So if they're on the rolls and they present some other kind of ID, whether it's a state government ID or a federal government ID, something that establishes their identity, then they should be able to vote a regular ballot if they're willing to sign an affidavit, certainly. That would seem, as was done in Wisconsin. And even in North Carolina, where there were problems with the provisional ballots in similar circumstances, where you could go, if you didn't have the ID, sign an affidavit saying you were had a reasonable impediment, and then you were able to vote. But there you had to vote a provisional ballot, and it proved to be very problematic. Hundreds and hundreds of voters voted for with a provisional ballot in North Carolina, and hundreds of those ballots were not counted. The states have done a very poor job in Texas. The federal courts have found that Texas is woefully inadequate publicity about what the ID process was. So I think it's going to be up to us, those of us in the litigation, to really push for a strong, effective remedy. Remember, and I'll close with this, you had the federal court in D.C. found the law discriminatory. You've had the federal court in Corpus Christi, the trial court, find it. You found the Fifth Circuit panel found the law discriminatory. And now the most conservative U.S. Court of Appeals in the country rules 9-6, the law is discriminatory. We think that we ought to have a remedy that fully compensates for the discriminatory effect of the law, and that's what we intend to pursue now that we're back down in the trial court. So I'll stop there, Katie, and let you handle questions from yourself or our callers.
Thank you, Jerry, and thank you, Sean. I do have a couple of questions, but I also know we have a lot of callers, so in a few minutes I'm going to open it up to questions, but I'll ask a couple first. So one question that I got by email from someone who I believe is on the phone, and this is for both of you, but Sean, you can at least start out this. I know there's some question about how effective the affidavit options really have been in other states that have implemented those options, North Carolina and South Carolina, for instance. So I'm curious what your response is to that, how effective the option is, whether that really fixes the problem of the strict voter ID law in the first place. And in particular in Wisconsin, do we have any idea of what assurances what the system's going to look like and what assurances we will have that Wisconsin officials are going to know about this option and implement it effectively?
Well, that's a great question. And those are serious questions that we're taking a look at ourselves. We know that the Wisconsin Elections Commission, which is the head state head elections body, has issued a memo to all 1,800 or so municipal clerks telling them about this court order and that they need to start thinking about putting this affidavit together. We also know that the municipal clerks from the two largest Wisconsin municipalities, Milwaukee and Madison, are fully committed to making sure that this affidavit remedy is implemented in time for November and implemented well. Both of those municipal clerks submitted declarations in support of our motion for a preliminary injunction. But look, as we've seen in North South Carolina, we can't just, you know, sit on our hands and see what happens. We have to make sure, we need folks on the ground to make sure that the affidavit remedy is actually being publicized, it's actually being implemented, and that people aren't being turned away from the polls because they lack ID. And, you know, there's no easy way to do that other than having folks on the ground, election protection, and making sure that no one is disenfranchised.
Great. So that's a shout-out for election protection for our members. We will be circulating more information about that, and I would definitely encourage people who have the ability to volunteer for that.
And sorry, if I may just add one more thing.
Sure.
Look, we have a court order. We're prepared to enforce it if that's what we need to do.
Right.
So that's always on the table.
Right. Jerry, I have a question for you about the Texas case. The Texas case was remanded on the question of discriminatory intent. And I'm wondering what we've learned from that case about intent, and if you can sort of tell us why discriminatory intent is helpful to prove and what we've learned about how to prove it in this case.
Well, thanks. The Fifth Circuit did send the issue of intent back to the district court. It also told the district court that because it wanted to make sure that there was a remedy imposed for 2016, that the court should delay consideration of intent until after it comes up with the remedy to ensure that something is fashioned promptly and quickly in this case. Intent, what we've learned about it is that, and I will say that for those who haven't read the Fifth Circuit's decision, when you read it, it really very strongly details some of the reasons why the law is purposefully discriminatory and kind of sets a nice roadmap, frankly, for the district court when we ultimately rule on that, get a ruling on that issue. It employs, you know, the usual Arlington Heights factors, looks at the factors like whether there's a long history of discrimination and what the effect of the law is, what the statements made by proponents were about the law, and what, you know, measuring the state's interest against what they claim to be their interest versus the burden on the right to vote, the procedural irregularities and so on to the law. And it's important, especially important in a case like this, because it goes back to the Shelby County decision. If Texas is found to have engaged in conduct that's unconstitutional, and intentional discrimination is unconstitutional, then the district court will have the authority to reimpose a preclearance regime on the state of Texas for voter qualification laws and voter registration laws, which is critically important. And so I think, you know, on remand, we certainly, the VC team alleged discriminatory intent. We thought we've proved it. And we intend to urge the district court to find it and to impose relief under Section 3 of the Voting Rights Act that will, again, require some form of pre-approval for Texas's voting laws in the future, given its consistent record of discriminating against minority voters. And I do think, if I could just comment on the affidavit point that Sean made, we also, you know, it's important, I think, that poll officials, you know, have to be reminded that they can't deny people the right to vote. You know, even if they disagree with the decisions of the court, they're duty-bound to implement those. So if the poll official is unwilling to let somebody vote because they don't have an ID and violates the court order that present in Wisconsin or ultimately the court order in Texas, I think we have to be prepared to get relief immediately from the district court to enforce its order against poll officials who engage in that. And I'm very concerned about the fall elections. It's the first one since the Voting Rights Act was first passed in 1965, the first presidential election in which there'll be no preclearance, which will, you know, I'm fearful there'll be last-minute voting changes that harm minority voters. And equally concerned that the federal government has announced that it no longer has the authority to send federal poll watchers, federal observers, into polling places to actually be the eyes and ears to see how these photo ID remedies are implemented. So I think it's going to be even more important for us to be vigilant and attentive as the months unfold.
Thanks for that. You sort of got into this, but I want to give you a chance to say anything more you have to say about it and for Sean to chime in too. Yesterday was the 10th anniversary of President Bush's signing of the VRA reauthorization, but of course the Supreme Court struck down Section 5 3 years ago. What do these cases say about the Voting Rights Act, about its strength as it stands now and the need to re-up what Section 5, what we lost with Section 5?
I think, Jared.
Well, it certainly, yeah. I mean, it certainly shows in the case of Texas, where here we had a law that was passed that a federal, three-judge federal court found was discriminatory against African-American and Latino voters, and it was blocked because of Section 5. And when Shelby County came down, as I mentioned earlier, the law was suddenly allowed to be in effect, a law that had been found to be discriminatory. And so we've been litigating now since 2013 in the summer, 3 years into it, and we're still trying to get relief. you know, the Supreme Court in Shelby County said that, you know, they really felt that Congress needed to update the Voting Rights Act's coverage formula to decide who should have to undergo preclearance because, you know, Chief Justice Roberts' opinion felt that the time for discrimination was really had largely been resolved and that, you know, Congress needed to reexamine the coverage formula. I think this shows that how naive that decision really was, and maybe more than naive, unfortunately, that that you have places with a long history of intentional discrimination with respect to voting, and we have a law now found by, you know, four federal courts that's been discriminatory, which really, I think, shows how much of a burden time and inertia really has fallen on the shoulders of victims of discrimination rather than those who are perpetrating. And I think that it's really, the Supreme Court has done a great disservice to the nation and to our democracy by essentially allowing those who have engaged in centuries of discrimination against minority voters to have a free rein and only be subject to very costly and time-consuming lawsuits to stop their discriminatory conduct.
Yeah, I couldn't put it better myself.
Okay. Well, I think at this point we will open up the lines for questions.
If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. That's star and the number 1. Our first question comes from the line of Susan Anspach.
Thank you. Yes, I appreciate this conference call. It's been very enlightening. As someone who's been doing voter protection since the 2000 fiasco, I especially commend speakers on having regular ballots, not provisional ballots. That was just a cop-out and it wasn't, that never works. But my question goes to especially Wisconsin. What's the status of the affidavit? Has it been drafted and are folks going to need to pay money to get it notarized? Are there going to be special municipal clerks who are in a position to notarize these affidavits? Have any of the logistics been decided?
These are great questions. First, to our knowledge, the affidavits have not been formally drafted, but the court was pretty specific about what should go on there. So to my knowledge, they haven't been drafted. The second question about notary, they do not have to be notarized. This is a point that the court went out of its way to clarify. I know that typically when we say affidavit, those usually require notarizations. But these are more in the form of, you know, to practicing lawyers, more like a declaration. They don't have to be notarized. Poll workers will issue these affidavits to people, and they can sign them on the spot.
Great. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question comes from the line of Arthur Heitzer.
Well, it's a follow-up. So you said that the court order is relatively specific as to the content, but could you share with us, I'm in Wisconsin, you know, before you send someone who can't get an ID and maybe hasn't done a whole lot to do it, down to the to vote and fill out the declaration, what do you think they will have to declare?
According to the court order, and I have it in front of me, it says that the affidavit must contain the following language, quote, I declare under penalty of perjury that I am the individual identified below and that I have been unable to obtain acceptable photo identification with reasonable effort. This is due to the following reasons. And then it lists some checkboxes that the voter may fill out, including lack of transportation, lack of birth certificate or other documents needed to obtain photo ID, work schedule, disability or illness, family responsibilities. And then it has an other box where the voter can fill out why they cannot obtain ID with reasonable effort. And importantly, no one is permitted to challenge the reasonableness of their impediment to getting ID.
Any idea when those will be? When do you think it might be available? And should someone, for whatever reason, draft their own? Because they don't fit. I mean, I guess other sounds like it covers anything, but
it yeah. I, it's That's probably not going to fly. These affidavits, look, they need to be drafted soon. We haven't gotten any indications from the state that it has done it yet. It says it has issued a public memo saying that it will do it, and we'll be watching that closely. And if we need to go to court, we'll go to court. But, you know, we're watching. But in the meantime, folks, I guess, you know, one thing I would encourage is this, for people who work in these communities, try to help people get IDs. That, especially right now, if those efforts are unsuccessful, then they are likely to be able to sign the affidavit.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Mark Gruberg.
Yeah, one question for each of you. First of all, do either of you have plans for massive deployment of people at poll stations in Wisconsin and Texas or elsewhere on November 8th, given the past history and what we're going through? And the second part, and this is for I guess it's Mr. Haber for Texas. How much of a precedent for the rest of the country is that Fifth Circuit decision? I mean, we have North Carolina, we have Michigan, we have Indiana, which is the first case of this all the way back in 2007, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Hello?
Hi, sorry, I was waiting. To answer your first question, we, you know, generally, I believe our lawyers committee has an election protection network that we usually participate in, and they do a fantastic job of making sure there are folks on the ground. But, you know, like I said before, we can never have enough eyes and ears. You know, I think they usually deploy people in the most populated areas, but we need folks everywhere.
Okay.
Yeah, let me just add something to that. So starting in 2013, in largely response to Shelby County, we decided that because we knew that the burden of enforcing and protecting voting rights would largely fall on the shoulders of those of us in the voting rights community and on individual voters, we created something called the Voting Rights Institute, which is on the web now at www.votingrightsinstitute.org. And on there, we're trying to locate between now and the fall elections places where either the Justice Department previously used to go because of potential for voter intimidation and discrimination, and where they're no longer likely to go because they can't send poll watchers inside. And we're going to look to send people to some of those jurisdictions and others that come to our attention that we think are potential more problem areas. We have a lot of minority candidates who, by state law, are authorized to have poll watchers inside, and we're going to try to work with establish communication with them to make sure that people are on the inside as well as the outside so that we can deal with problems in real time rather than let them just, you know, happen and then find out about it later. So on the Voting Rights Institute's website, there is a place that we're going to have very soon that will allow you, like, volunteer opportunities. And one of the questions would be, are you willing to go to a particular place and be in the polls or at least be available on election day to help voters who are experiencing a problem, particularly in an area where you might live? And I think that's, you know, we're going to try to establish that network in the coming months. And I know that a lot of other groups, voting rights groups and civil rights groups, are going to be working to do that same thing. So we're going to try to pick up some of the slack, and I appreciate that question. On the question of the precedent for the Fifth Circuit's decision, you know, we've got the Seventh Circuit about probably to render yet another decision on a stay. You've got their previous decision on the merits that Sean mentioned, that split 5-5 for rehearing. You've got the Fourth Circuit that has held an oral argument recently in all of the North Carolina vote suppression cases, and I think we'll have a decision there. And now we'll have the Fifth Circuit, and, you know, it isn't necessarily true, but if Sean's successful in the Seventh Circuit, and we've been successful in the Fifth, and I'm predicting that the plaintiffs in the North Carolina will be successful there, we may not have much of a conflict among the circuits. I do think the winds are changing here a little bit when it comes to voting, because everybody is aware that there's a 8-justice court right now, and so Texas announced, for example, that it was not going to seek Supreme Court review of the Fifth Circuit's decision, which was monumentally important because it allowed us to really go back to the district court quickly and not be concerned with a stay. And remember that with a 4-4 split, they probably felt that they weren't in a position maybe to get 5 votes. So everybody has kind of taken these cases in the Court of Appeals or in 3-judge federal courts and kind of looked at it in terms of, you know, what is going to happen if there's a 4-4 affirmance until we get a 9th justice. So all that to say that I think it's certainly going to have a precedential effect in Mississippi and Louisiana and, of course, in Texas. But I don't know that the en banc decision, until other cases are litigated, are going to it'll have much impact in other circuits just yet. Although it is a very thoughtful opinion of several hundred pages in length, and the Court of Appeals was very comprehensive in its treatment of all of these issues. And remember, we were dialing back from that Indiana case, which, you know, many people thought it was a death knell for photo ID litigation, but I think as Sean's team has proven and as our team has proven, and I think North Carolina as well, I think we're showing that that ultimately photo ID laws can successfully be challenged when they discriminate or when they burden the fundamental right to vote.
If I can just add one thing, and I hate to just add this little thing after that fantastic summary by Jerry. Folks should also consider being poll workers. That being actually on the inside, you can have a really monumental impact. You know, you can help other poll workers inform them about the affidavit option. You can help make sure it's implemented correctly. And that's something that's not often discussed and should be more.
Completely agree with that.
I think we have time for another question if there's anybody else on the line.
Our next question comes in the line of Robert Barnes. I'm sorry.
Hi, this is Bob Barnes from the Washington Post. I was wondering if you could talk about the inevitable sort of partisan nature of this litigation. The laws were written by Republican legislatures with your groups aside and some others. They're also being challenged by Democratic groups. How does that play into what do you think the courts should do or how they view these questions? And related to that, if I'm not wrong, I think for a while, especially on voter ID, you had a period in which Republican judges were voting one way, Democratic-appointed judges were voting another. That certainly wasn't the case in the Texas case. And so I'm wondering if you could address that as well.
Sean, is it okay if I go first?
Yeah, please.
Okay. So, Bob, thank you for the question. And you're absolutely right that these cases are largely seen as partisan cases, and in many cases our partisan intent was a part of the reason they enacted them. And you saw the Republican legislatures enacting the Wisconsin photo ID, the Texas photo ID, the North Carolina photo ID, and other vote suppression measures there. And Democrats really across the board in the legislature voting against it. And what was remarkable, I thought, initially about the Texas case was the first panel that we had a trial in front of in D.C. included one Republican appointee to presidential appointee to the 3-judge court who found that the law was discriminatory. And then, in the course, as you pointed out, both the panel decision had a Republican, one of the most influential Republicans on the Fifth Circuit, rule that the law was discriminatory. And then, of course, 9 judges, a number of whom were Republican appointees on the Fifth Circuit, finding it was discriminatory. And I think what the courts are saying is that, yes, there may have been partisan motivations, but when it comes to denying the right to vote and discriminate against minority voters with a voting law, that it doesn't matter to the victim of discrimination whether you're doing it for partisan reasons or whether you're doing it because of the skin color that they happen to have or the language that they speak. You're still taking away their right to vote, and you can't use partisanship as a justification for discriminating against minority voters. And just to add one kind of finer point on this, I think what we've seen with like partisan gerrymandering cases in the Supreme Court, the court has been unwilling and unable, at least, to articulate a partisan gerrymandering standard. And what has happened as a result is that redistricting cases get cabined as racial cases, when in fact, sometimes they're both racial and partisan. Redistricting is, after all, a partisan act in and of itself. So I think the same is true with the voter ID cases, where courts, I think, have said, well, yeah, there's a partisan motivation here. How do we separate that out from the racial motivation? But if there's a racial motivation, and there's strong evidence in these Texas cases that there was, then we don't really need to address whether it was also partisan, because the evidence of racial discrimination was so rampant and overwhelming. Sean, I don't know what you want to add to what I've said.
Oh, I think all I would say is that, you know, from the ACLU's perspective, voting is not a partisan issue. Restrictions, unjustifiable restrictions on the right to vote, have to be struck down, regardless of partisan intent or non-intent. And these voting rights cases are also not just about one election. I know a lot of folks understandably like to focus on the presidential election every 4 years, but these voting restrictions affect every election, municipal elections, down ballot elections, and every single election is important.
Okay, I think we have time for one more quick question, if there is one.
We have a question from the line of Mark Walsh.
Hi, this is Mark Walsh. I also cover the Supreme Court for the ABA Journal, among other outlets, but I'm writing on this for the ABA Journal. And Gerald, you did answer one question of mine about whether Texas might appeal, and you say not, so that sort of settles things maybe down to work on the remedy there. Sean, I would wonder about Wisconsin, whether things might move on two tracks, and whether with, you know, the Fourth Circuit decision pending, will there be any sense of certainty as we move closer to election day, or does the fact that there's only an 8-member court maybe make it less likely that we see appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think I can't really speculate on that. All I do know is that Wisconsin has appealed the district court's preliminary injunction to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and we're confident that the court will see things our way. But beyond that, I can't speculate.
Mm-hmm. And Mark, let me just add one thing. Yes, it is true that Texas announced it would not appeal to the Supreme Court the Fifth Circuit's ruling on that there was a violation, but that, of course, we now are trying to agree upon a remedy, and then ultimately there'll be briefing on the intent issue and then a final judgment. And Texas has a history of appealing everything that they lose. So, to quote Yogi Berra, it ain't over till it's over. So there could be an appeal down the road at some point, but certainly not for now, and certainly not on the issue of a violation, at least for 2016.
And Gerald, can I ask you one specific thing? You said, I do think this something's are changing here, and I was actually trying to catch that quote. Do you remember what you said a few minutes ago?
Yeah, I think the winds are changing with respect
Wheels?
To voting rights in the courts.
Okay.
I think the winds are changing. I've sensed it when in arguing cases before judges and looking at the way they're asking questions now, and I think part of it is the fact that there is an 8-member court, and that changes the dynamics. Whoever wins in the Court of Appeals essentially feels that, you know, it's going to be difficult for the other side to overturn that with a 8-justice court. So I do think that the winds are changing, but I also think that I think a lot of people are seeing with a lot of the laws that have been enacted since Shelby County that the Supreme Court's decision saying that really discrimination was more a thing of the past just is not true. And I think that they're recognizing that there's no right that we have more fundamental to us as Americans than the right to vote. It's our voice in democracy. And I think they're affording it the protection it deserves. And I do think it's changing.
And I think that is a beautiful way to end the conversation. I'm sorry, but it is almost 1 o'clock, so I am going to go ahead and wrap up. If there are any reporters on the line who have additional questions, please feel free to get in touch with me at kocnnor@acslaw.org. I'm happy to put you in touch with the two speakers. I want to thank you both, Sean and Jerry, for doing this for us, and to you and the many, many organizations and individuals that made these victories possible. Thanks to all the participants on the call, and have a great day, everyone.
That concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect your lines.